Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to the Sans Pants Network,
home of comedy,
culture, adventures,
and ghosts.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George Dimrellis. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, she started in Australia. She studied also in Finland and is now based in France. She's a postdoctoral researcher interested in the similarities between music and language in relation to syntax, rhythm, memory, and attention. Anna Fiveash, it's great to have you on the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I definitely took that intro from one of your many summaries.
Is that quite familiar? Yeah, thank you.
Look, why fix what's not broken? That's how I see it.
It was perfect.
Nice, yes. Yeah. So you are now based in Lyon in France, although right now the weather's probably a bit cooler, maybe?
Weather not amazing at the moment. It's been snowing all weekend. It's kind of 0 degrees. But when you're inside, it's okay. It's still beautiful. Yeah. There's still baguettes and saucisson and chocolate and all the good things. So,
I'd happily take the cold in that, to be honest. That sounds delightful.
Exactly. And you have the mulled wine, so it's okay. It's fine.
You're sounding more French by the second. Okay. can you speak French? Do you need to speak French being there?
So I'm trying, actively learning. It's a difficult kind of language to learn. But when I moved here, I started learning pretty quickly because it is hard to get around without any French. I've been kind of learning French. I've been here almost 5 years now, or four to five. So I can get by. I can have conversations, and I don't sound too much like an idiot. But we're getting closer at that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's good. So why did you go there? Why are you in Lyon?
Basically, it was for the job. So I did my PhD in music and language syntax, the structure of music and language. And I've always been interested in music and language, and kind of you have to find the next job after your PhD. And one of my friends, actually Rebecca Gelding, who you were talking to recently, I think, she's really great at Twitter. And she found a tweet that was just like a screenshot of an email that was a job description for a job in Lyon, looking at music and language and rhythm, which is super interesting. I hadn't looked at rhythm at that stage. So I applied. I had an interview, and then I got it. So I literally finished my PhD and then moved 3 weeks later to France. So I did a bit of my Duolingo before, but, you know, finishing the PhD and packing and moving countries, it wasn't didn't have a lot of time to learn. So yeah, that's why I came for the job, and it's awesome. It's really cool. So.
Right, okay. Well, we can talk about it with this. So just quickly, because you started off, it seemed like in psychology before moving to focus on music as well. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's music psychology as well. So like my bachelor was all psychology, and the idea was to become a psychologist. But then kind of things changed, and I did a research year, like the honours year in Australia. You guys know what that means. Here I can't explain it like that. So then I was like, okay, well, I needed to do a research project. Love psychology, love the mind. How do people think? But my other kind of love is music. So basically I kind of put those together, and that's how I ended up doing this. And then I just kind of kept following that. So
that sounds like the exact idea of following your passion.
Oh, totally. Honestly, yeah. That's just what I've been doing, and it's worked really well so far. I hope it keeps going. Yeah.
That's great. So is that when you say you were into music, like I'm assuming more than just like I like listening to some songs, did you play as well? Or like when you say into music, what does that mean?
Yeah. So I was playing classical guitar since I was about 6. So I tried piano, but it didn't work out. So I was like, oh, guitar is so much cooler. You know, when you're 6, you want to play guitar. So I was, learning guitar, got really into classical guitar. So up till I was maybe 18 and my parents told me they'd stop paying for it. So then I kind of stopped classical and went more into kind of writing songs and just playing for fun and singing and everything. So yeah, I guess all of that background kind of led me into this as well. Because you need a bit of music knowledge to be able to do the good music research. Because if you have to make the stimuli and everything, you need to know a little bit about it. So actually a lot of people in my field are musicians, which is really nice. And when you go to conferences, there's lots of dancing and jamming and stuff. So it's really cool.
That is cool. All right. That sounds like a lot more fun than other conferences, to be honest.
I really think it is too.
Yeah, a lot less dry.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
So let's go with the book. That's really interesting. So because I actually want to talk about. Yeah, it sounds perfect. So let's go with your book, and then we'll jump around from there. So your book of choice for today is.
So I have it right here. I'll show you, but no one else can see. But it's called Music, Language, and the Brain, by Anirudh Patel, and this is kind of like the tomb of music and language research. It's from 2008, so it's a bit older, but it still has all of the kind of foundations, I suppose, across all of the different ways that we could look at similarities and differences between music and language.
And that's because it sounds like this is a relatively new field in terms of trying to science it, scientify yeah, totally. It, because obviously the discussion of music and language, it seems to be ancient, but in terms of, trying to actually look at the, I guess I've got to say, neurochemical makeup of what the similarities are, is that relatively new?
Beautiful. I wouldn't say chemical, but maybe neurobiological.
I was trying to say fancy words. I don't know what
it sounded. It sounded good. I'll take it.
It did. No. Thank you for correcting it.
There's chemicals involved.
Yeah. No. Neurobiological makeup. Yeah, because how the brain reacts to what it's hearing, essentially, and the similarities between the two. With that, okay, so what is that? Like, how are they similar, I guess, is the first question. And is that a new realize? Like, I'm guessing did people always know that these things were similar? Actually, take a step back. How are they similar, I guess, is the first question.
Okay, these are lots of good questions. So I'm going to start
that's why I'm trying to go slow.
Yeah. So I'm just going to go with the backwards thing. So the idea of music kind of as a communicative thing, I don't want to say as a language, but as a way to communicate, is very, very old. Like you've got the ancient philosophers, Darwin, Plato, like everyone. I don't know if Darwin would be classified as a philosopher, but anyway, you have a lot of people in the olden days saying that, music is really important and it's great for the brain. And obviously music and language have both been around forever. And there's lots of kind of evolutionary things there, which we could discuss later a little bit if you want. But the idea of actually looking at music as a formal kind of scientific exploration pathway is pretty new. I'd say the last 20 or 30 years. No, more than that, maybe 40 years. I started 10 years ago, so then it was 20, maybe 30, 40 yeah. now. So basically it was kind of starting to figure. So we had a lot more research about language because language is more kind of obviously important, because we have to communicate, we use language to communicate. But people started thinking, okay, maybe we can find similar kind of neural responses in music as well. So there's a lot of cool things. So when you make errors in language, so if you make a meaning error, like my dog ate socks for breakfast, something like this, your brain has this specific response, right? And so people were trying to say, oh, what if we can find this specific response in music too? Like, does the brain do the same thing? So it kind of started like this, looking at if we kind of make a really bad chord, like you're playing a nice piece of music and then you go, oh, like this out of key thing, does the brain respond in the same way? And actually what they found was it wasn't the same as the meaning response in the brain. So it wasn't like we call it semantic, if the meaning of language or the meaning of music, but it was more a structural response. So if you have like a grammatical error in language, for example, I'm not good at coming up with these quickly, but
like dog, cat, ate pizza, something like that.
Sure. Like you're good at this. Okay.
Getting the words wrong, I guess. Yeah, that's what you mean. Like a more fundamental flaw than just like a meaning being strange is like,
Right.
Yeah.
Because like exactly, your dog could eat socks for breakfast. You just wouldn't expect it, right? But with the syntactic error, the structure is bad. You can't say that in language. So it's kind of similar in music. If you have a really out of key chord, your brain responds in the same way as if you have a grammatical error in language. And this is kind of indistinguishable. This is also Annie Patel who discovered this kind of the really close similarity in how the brain is responding in music and language to these structural errors. And that's kind of really cool and suggests that maybe we don't have separate brain areas to do a very similar thing, actually. It's just we use the same brain, it's economical, right? We use the same brain areas to kind of process both music and language. So this is kind of a general area.
There's so much there already. Okay, so the first thing I'd want to ask, and this might be impossible to answer, but maybe the studies haven't been done, but is that a learnt thing? Like, as in, is that something which with when it comes to music and a rhythm, not rhythm, although I want to talk about that as well. I'm very interested in the rhythm side of things. Yeah. But in terms of the notes, I guess it's interesting because, like, we're talking about harmony. We're talking about an off key. Does it always sound off to everyone? Is it so foundational a sound that we all agree on what it, like, it just sounds wrong on a human level almost. Is that how they've proven, or is there any proof on that? Is there theories about that?
Yeah, this is a really nice question. So basically we get our knowledge of what chords, what notes go together through kind of, there's two kind of trains of thought about this, right? But the way, I'm just going to tell you the one I kind of follow, is that we use kind of statistical learning or implicit learning. So when we're a baby, even before we're born, we're picking up on what types of notes go together, right? And that's statistical learning. So even when you're learning a language, you say, okay, these types of words always go together and these types of notes always go together. So as you get older and older and you have more exposure to that musical or language system, that's how you kind of develop this really strong sense of what sounds good and what sounds not good. So there's this cultural side that you are picking this up, and that differs depending on your specific culture too. So you've got the kind of Western music where we have certain types of out of key notes, but you've also got a lot of other types of musical cultures where perhaps the same kind of out of key note wouldn't sound out of key. But saying that, there is also a kind of biological reason that the dissonant chords sound bad, right? So I think, who was this? There was one of the ancient people who did great work, looked at this consonance versus dissonance, basically if it sounds good or bad together. And that is also kind of a biological thing in our brain to a certain extent, like the ratios of how things go together. So I think it's both, basically. It's this whole nature-nurture thing.
Yeah, again. But I mean, like, I guess, by the way, whenever I think ancient saying something, I always just go Aristotle, probably Aristotle, because Aristotle's the first one to be, like, properly scientific about a broader range of things with, I'm geeking out now.
But yes, it's probably Aristotle. I think, it could be Aristotle. I'll go with that.
Yeah. He wrote because he did some stuff on what is art and what makes good art and stuff. So this sounds like it would fall into that.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, we'll say Aristotle said this.
I guess on that note, so you're saying that there can be surface level differences where there is difference between cultures, essentially, but there are more fundamental ones, which doesn't matter the culture. You're always going to get it wrong. That sounds about, because this ties into, and like, it sounds like you've approached this more from the music side with this whole question, but this does make me think of like the language side, which it seems from my, obviously I'm not a linguist, but it seems like Noam Chomsky was the guy who kind of revolutionized the understanding there, being like, language isn't something you learn. It's phrased, one of those great metaphors, but it's something that you grow. So you're born with it and then you just grow it in a certain way, but it's not a blank slate where you can do anything. It's very much inbuilt. And then you grow it in a certain way. So it sounds like you're saying music falls into the same category.
So this is really interesting, because this is kind of the big debate in the whole of science, right? Like, do we have it to begin with, or do we grow it, basically? And I think Noam Chomsky's argument was that language is so complex that we can't just learn it, right? There has to be something in our brain, and it's this universal grammar. Like, we have this in our brain already, and then we kind of switch some switches depending on what language we end up in, and then we can learn the language. Whereas the more statistical learning side is saying, look, we have so much input from our environment, like, all the time. And when you're young, like, parents are speaking to you in this infant-directed speech, really emphasizing the segments in the syllables between words, everything. So I'm not going to pick a horse on that one, but basically you've got these two sides, and really in the end you were born with a brain, right? You have something there already, and then you kind of hone it into whatever culture you're in and whatever languages and experiences you have. So
pick a side. Come on, Anna. Let's go.
I know.
We've got to be more bold here. Pronouncements. It's done.
I mean, I am more on the I am more on the statistical learning side. I'll give you that. But obviously, Chomsky is an amazing thinker, and he's kind of gone through all these kind of revolutions in linguistics, where every time he releases a book, the whole field kind of changes. And it's really, I'm not a linguist. I'm a psychologist who is kind of specialized in music and language. And so, I'm not on the linguistic pathway, but it's super interesting how that has developed. And that's just really kind of quickly going back. That's when music started becoming more of something that people were kind of really able to study, when some Lerdahl and Jackendorf released a book looking at generative musical syntax. Basically, it's called the Generative Theory of Tonal Music, and they kind of put in principles that were kind of similar to the linguistic principles. And from that was 1983, so that was kind of the first formal, I mean, there were ones before, but this was the first one where you could really say, okay, I'm going to test this. Guess that's where the science side kind of came out a bit stronger.
It's just that foundation, because that core value, because you mentioned it somewhere, but like, because I guess one of the examples I think of is, I'm not a musician at all, but like I actually played a bit of guitar when I was younger, but not much and stopped not very well. But I have some slight appreciation, and a piano as well, like at least I understand chords and like how they, logic of what they are. And I always noticed one thing I always found was funny is if I'm sitting on the piano, all I have to do is press one of the notes a few times, and then my brain kind of goes, okay. And then you start going up the scale from that note, and your brain knows where the next note is meant to be. And then you just reset it. You just go play the next note, and then you can like kind of go, and then you're like, oh no, that should be flat. And I always wonder how much that is like innate, or whether that's like, whether you're learning that, or that's just the harmony of the universe essentially. So is there like a,
that's definitely learned, I'd say.
That's learned. Okay.
But the fact that those notes are the ones that go together could be more innate in terms of the acoustic structures of that, you know, if it's consonant, but then we've kind of created these kind of scales and everything.
But like that's us putting a human attempt on these natural, because I guess that this is why I find it so interesting, because when you talk about music and language and how its impact on the brain, I guess it's like, are there sounds in nature which sound better? Because that's kind of what we're saying with this. We're saying there's certain sounds which sound better or not, and like, then we're just formalizing it almost, but it's already there in a neurobiological sense.
Perfect. I totally say that. I think that's, I think it was Aristotle actually. But I think it's something to do with kind of the frequencies in the pitches as well. So when you play a note, that's a certain frequency. So an A note on the piano, the middle A is 440 hertz, I think. And then you can kind of play kind of harmonics of this, and you can kind of, different notes, because of their frequencies and how they interact in your ear, they actually sound better. So our ear inside in the cochlea, you kind of have all these kind of, I won't go too much into detail. I know it's a bit boring, but
I'm engaged.
Okay, cool. But basically, as you get kind of higher in frequencies, it's harder to distinguish between different notes, basically. So when you're kind of lower, there's kind of a special range for humans we're really good at, and we can really distinguish very small differences in pitch. But as you go higher, the ways of telling the difference gets broader, right? So it's harder to tell the difference. So I think it's related to this in terms of your kind of upper harmonics. Too much detail again, but basically if they're not sounding well, if they're not sounding good together, that's also based on your ear and what we can perceive. So I think really we have this kind of innate structure that we're born with, and then yeah, based on this, we have created these whole systems. But there are differences between kind of Western music structure, which we know the best, I would say, and different musical structures. So even though we have some similarities in terms of basic consonants and dissonance, like what sounds good and bad generally, there are also differences in the scales. So
like just in terms, yeah, in terms of how they're put together and what goes with what in a larger sense. The reason I'm like going on this a bit, because it's a direction I wanted to go with it, because I know in one of the things when I was looking at it, you I don't know if you wrote it yourself or something there where it was like, it might have actually been in the review for the book, Human, the Brain and, yeah, Language and Music and Human Brain. It mentioned specific, I think you used the phrase distinctly human skill. Look, Matt, I should have just read it out before. Do I have it here? Uniquely human abilities, I think it says, something like that, when it's describing music and language as uniquely human abilities. It specifically says that in the blurb, I think.
Totally. And that's a part which I was. Introduction.
Yeah, yeah. So the fact that it's calling both these traits uniquely human is interesting to me, because, like, language, it's pretty obviously in its complexity uniquely human, but, like, even now I'm not sure. And with music, in a weird way, I guess it almost seems more human appreciating music, but is it uniquely human? I guess so. Like, is that something you would know anything about? Is it uniquely, like, especially with music, which is your skill set? Do animals like a good tune? Like, you know.
This is a complicated question, and so there's a lot more research coming now, looking at how animals perceive pitch, rhythm, everything, and basically, yeah, the general consensus is that music and language are uniquely human in terms of the way that we think of them, right? But there's also like obviously birds in particular, they have a very complex bird pitch. Like they sing songs to each other, and they sing songs that have meaning and communication between each other. And you can teach animals to tap in time. The thing with that is that typically humans, when we're tapping along to something, we predict it, right? So we tap just before. But with animals, they're kind of showing more and more that they're tapping just after. So they can learn the task, but they're reacting. They're not predicting so much.
Right.
So in that kind of sense, I mean, humans have these more complex systems, but I wouldn't rule out that animals also have kind of differences in terms of music. Like they it's different, definitely, and that's one of the difficult things about music and language, is that we can't study it in animals in the same way. Like, this is why vision, audition to a point, like really basic audition, a long time ago, we're looking at in kind of rats or birds or whatever, even now a little bit, and we can understand how the brain works. But for music and language, we really have to do it in humans. Right. And so it's a lot harder to kind of figure out what's happening in the brain, because we can't go that deep until people die, you know. And then even then, you can't hear the music language. So you have to do it in live humans, and that's difficult. So.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't it also be better to do it in a live one where you can see the, like, obviously with the recent technology, MRIs and that, to actually see those impacts, you would need them to be alive?
Yeah, totally. I was just thinking, like, you can see the structure of the brain. Like, I'm thinking back to when people were discovering the brain. There was a lot of autopsies and kind of figuring out where things are. And in animals, you can present like a flashing light and you can see what happens in the brain, because you can implant electrodes really deeply into the brain. I don't do any of this research, by the way. I wouldn't be good at doing these things to animals, but I'm not saying it's a good thing. But yeah.
Yeah.
Humans, you have to be less invasive, basically.
Yeah, I guess so. I just because you mentioned it specifically with the bird song, because that's probably an example where you would have a much more thorough knowledge of this than me, but it's almost like bird songs sound good usually, but then again, maybe they don't. Like, so do bird songs have, like, have they done tests on whether birds have a a harmony in their ear as well? And is it different to humans? Like, is in the certain off keys that we would 100% put in the discordant category that birds love? Or is there like not that? Like, is that something which has got any research on?
Great question. And I really don't know. So I don't want to kind of make something up, but I would say, yeah, when I've, as a just a person, not a scientist, when I've heard bird song, it sounds, yeah, it sounds good. Like it sounds consonant, right? There are people doing this study, so I wouldn't say, you know, I just don't know about it, basically.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's fair enough. That's yeah.
Just but it's cool. It's cool.
Yeah,
you're getting out of my expertise now with the animal stuff. So.
Okay, well, let's bring it back to your expertise then. So what exactly are your research stuff at the moment looking at in terms of the music focus versus the language with the brain?
Yeah, so right now I'm looking at rhythm. So a lot of the studies, so I'm working with Barbara Tillman in Lyon, and she's really great. She's doing a lot of research on rhythmic priming. And this is the idea that if you kind of play a really regular sequence, like do-do-do-do-do-do-do, like a really regular beat, and you play that for kind of 30 seconds or so, the idea is that your brain starts to entrain to this rhythm, right? So your kind of neural oscillations, your brain waves, start to kind of synchronize with the music that you're hearing, if it's regular, if it's predictable. And the idea here is when you stop the music, your brain waves keep going, right? They don't just stop immediately. And then that could kind of help the processing of speech. So then what we do is we present really regular music for a while with the idea to entrain the brain to this particular rhythm. And then we present speech stimuli, like 2-second sentences, just spoken naturally. And we ask kids, we ask adults, was this sentence grammatically correct or incorrect? And basically the kind of comparison, so we do this with regular rhythms or irregular rhythms. So irregular rhythms, you can't hear, there's no rhythmic structure, right? It's just like doop, 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 doop. There's no structure. Then what we really see across lots of studies is that people, especially children, are better at these grammaticality judgments after the regular rhythms compared to the irregular rhythms.
Okay. I was gonna say, so it messes up their brain, like understanding a bit, doing the wrong rhythm. Not messes up in a bad way, but like as in it throws that out, their measurement device.
Well, we kind of actually think that the regular rhythm is kind of boosting the perception of the speech signal, rather than the regular is just kind of like a control. And so we also have other controls like environmental sounds, because like you have to compare, you have to tell if it's boosting or not boosting, right? Cost or benefit sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So what we've kind of shown across a few studies now that actually the because when you have a regular rhythm, your kind of your attention is not constant, right? Because we can't constantly keep attention on something. So our brain is really clever, and it predicts when we should put attention. So if you've got like a regular rhythm that just keeps going, our brain is sending kind of attention bursts at these points in time. And the idea is that if you then play sentences, the cool thing about this is that the speech signal actually has similar frequencies often, like the recurring rhythmic structures are kind of similar to music. So the idea is that your attention is directed to speech in kind of the good areas, so you're perceiving the signal better because your attention is more directed.
So when you I'm trying to understand that. So you mean like as in when someone's talking to you and you're perceiving their speech? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, totally. Oh, I was talking about in our experiments, but also when you're listening to someone, you're paying attention. There's also a rhythmic structure in speech, right? So when I'm talking like this, there's a certain rhythm to it. And in English, particularly, it's based on when you put the emphasis, like the stress. So there, stress. I put the stress on the syllable. And our brain, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that our brain is following this rhythmic structure in terms of where we put the stress on the syllables.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right, so because, I mean, obviously no one talks in a very, like some people do, in a very monotone or very repetitive way, but I feel like most people don't really fall into that in any obvious way. But you're saying they actually do, but you can't tell. Is that what you're saying? Or
no, not necessarily. It's just, it's not, obviously speech isn't isochronous. Like it's not completely bam, 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 you know. But yeah. When you look across lots of speech, you actually have around 4 or 5 hertz, which means 4 or 5 times per second, there's regularities. So this is the, when we say a syllable, like syllable is each bit, we do that 4 to 5 times a second when we're speaking. And in terms of when we put our stress, yeah, if you think about it, so 1 second, 1 second.
So you're saying is even in the sentences I'm making right now, there's a lot of words going in per second, which are going to be alternating in their rhythm. Is that right?
Yeah. And here you'd really talk about syllables. So the because syllables kind of give the speech units and then they're grouped into the words. So basically across lots of different languages, which is cool as well, generally there's a peak around 4 or 5 hertz, 4 or 5 times per second, where we see the syllable rate. And then we have another peak around 2 hertz, 2 times a second, which is where we put the stress. So you're saying lots of syllables, but every kind of two times a second, you're putting more emphasis on the syllable.
Really? So and like there's some irregularity in that, even though, because yeah, like I said, we feel like we would be varying quite a lot in how we say stuff when we're talking, da 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 da, but actually there's some regularity and uniformity within that.
Yeah, totally. Wow. So you kind of, this was one of the other big things in music language science. People were trying to find if speech was isochronous somehow or like regular, like rhythm, like music rhythm. And it isn't, right? It really isn't. But there are, in terms of if you look at kind of the, you meant to call it in terms of prominence and grouping and stress. So this is how we kind of understand speech rhythm now. Yeah, there's definitely similarities within languages, across languages, where we're kind of speaking in somewhat of a regular way, and that helps other people perceive us better, right? So if someone suddenly stops their speech or gets really slow or fast or something, we have to change our predictions of what they're going to do. And this is kind of cool as well. Like if you're listening to someone who speaks really, really fast, often the other person matches their speech rate, for example, because that helps. It's a really important perception production loop in the brain for speech and for music. So if you're kind of perceiving someone speaking really fast, you kind of end up speaking really fast too to kind of be able to match their speech rate and be able to better predict what they're going to say.
Right. Okay, that's really interesting. Like, I mean, the first thought that comes to mind is, I guess, if you want to be capturing people's attention easily, it would be to really modulate your speech a lot while talking to someone, like go slow, up, down, and all that stuff. That just immediately makes your brain just get hijacked, almost be like, what's going on here? And just pay attention more.
Yeah totally. But also you're ruining their predictions as well, right? It's not just, so your brain has to work harder as well if that happens.
So do you reckon that could have an impact on people's retention or something like that?
Oh, good question. Coming across? Typically, well, good question. So if you're paying more attention to something, often you remember it better, right? Mm. Yeah, so possibly.
Yeah, it's just making it, it's just waking it up, forcing it to engage more than just like sitting back and being like, yeah, I know what this rhythm is. I don't need to do anything else. Okay, I'll, as a stand-up comedian, I will try to use this in future as much as possible.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. I was just thinking, it's a good example with like a foreign accent, because you're not. This is what I get a lot in French, right? It's hard to, the speech rhythm, when I speak in French, my speech rhythm is not as a normal French person would say. So actually, really French people who don't speak English have more trouble to understand me because they don't understand the kind of the speech structure of English. But my friends who speak English as well, and I'm speaking to them in French, they understand me a lot better. So if you have kind of, you really need to have an idea of, to be able to predict what they're trying to say, basically.
Yeah, yeah. To be able to understand it almost in that sense. Like, yeah, that's interesting because like you always think of accents being more about, you know, the sound and like how it inflects, but like you don't actually think about now the set rhythms that every language would have, which would all be unique.
Yeah, it's super important. Like if you're like, so there's this kind of distinction with sentences or languages that are stress timed. So there's kind of similar intervals between the stresses and more syllable timed in terms of the similar intervals between the syllables. So French is more a syllable timed language, even though there's not so much research to support this. I'll put that out there as well. But there's kind of a perceptual difference between French and English, for example. And really, like, I have to be more monotone in French and more kind of specific in terms of when I'm speaking. And if I put too much stress, like I say, I used to go into the bakery saying bonjour, and they didn't like that. They immediately knew that I wasn't French because there's so much, the inflection is too high, it's not the right, I'm putting too much bonjour, like you have to say bonjour. It's really important.
So
you have to learn the rhythm of the speech as well if you're learning a new language, for sure. There's a lot of differences between speech rhythms and also a lot of similarities. So, yeah, we've got it all.
Yeah. And I guess that's where, like, the comparison, like, to go the speech thing and maybe in music as well, the best thing, obviously, it's not a cold double-blind experiment, but looking at completely different cultures and seeing what is the same versus what's different, and that's the best way you can develop some sort of universal theory of music and language. Is that?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And this is happening more and more recently. People are realizing how important this is. And so Nori Jacobi is someone who's really great looking at rhythm across different cultures. So he kind of goes into, I don't know, I think the last one was Botswana, I'm not quite sure, into these remote tribes where they haven't been exposed. See, the other thing, it's getting harder and harder to find places that aren't exposed to Western music, but they're kind of finding these small tribes that don't have exposure to Western music and then figuring out, yeah, what they find good or bad or what they find rhythmic or their rhythms. And it's really cool to look at this. And this is really important research because we're so immersed in our culture that we have trouble, like we can't look evolutionarily, right? Because the sound can't be fossilized. That's one of the problems. Music and language, it happened, and we have some evidence at some points, like someone made a little bone flute or there's a cave that looked like people might have danced, but we really don't have good lasting evidence for music and language. So it's kind of the second best thing is to go to these tribes where they haven't had exposure to anything else and just to see if they have similarities to the Western music and language. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. Like, I guess straight away with that, my thought would be that music, there might be variation. Like, even though I think there's probably would be a lot of universality, but with rhythm, rhythm's rhythm. Like, as in you can't, like stable rhythm's a stable rhythm. Everyone's going to like that everywhere, right? That's your brain's predictive. I mean, it's so fundamental, rhythm. Like, how could that be different?
No, totally. But like in terms of the like syncopation, like what kind of ratios of syncopation are enjoyable? Like, I'm not going to do it, but like there's all these separate, like all these little bits, right? And music isn't just one beat. It's happening at multiple levels. And this is something I haven't said yet, but one of the most important kind of similarities between music and language is in terms of hierarchical structure. And that kind of just means that we're not just looking at something on one level. Like if we have the do-do-do, just one beat, actually there's lots of things happening. You have like your stress, for example, you have a do 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 do. Like you have kind of different levels of structure, both in rhythm and in terms of the kind of content as well. Like right. In if you look at a language phrase, I think language is often easier to explain, and then you go to kind of the music side. But if you have all your individual words, which are grouped into like little phrases, which are grouped into sentences, which are grouped into bigger structures. So basically the idea is that you're looking at multiple levels, and that's what maybe could be different across cultures. I'm not sure.
Right. Because with rhythm especially, it's like dancing is obviously a big part of dancing, and obviously dancing is different between cultures. But again, I keep going back to this just because of the human uniqueness thing, and you might not know an answer to this, but do animals dance?
Oh, great question. Actually, I do have an answer for this. So have you seen on YouTube, there's all these videos of cockatoos that are like synchronizing with the rhythm?
That's what I'm thinking. Like, I don't know if it was cockatoos, but I feel like I remember bopping heads from like, yeah, birds or something where they're just hearing something. So yeah, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
So obviously there's a lot of, so I think someone looked across, maybe Annie Patel as well, looked across all these YouTube videos of animals dancing just to check like what's happening. But the problem with that is that we often can't tell if the person behind the camera is kind of giving them a signal, right? Like with the horse who learned how to count. Do you hear about this? Like actually someone behind the camera was giving clues which made the horse understand what he meant them to do. So actually Annie Patel did this study with this cockatoo called Snowy. If you type cockatoo Snowy into YouTube, and they actually, so they played, I think Michael Jackson was his favorite music. And they played it, and the cockatoo would dance, and actually had different levels, like would dance at one beat and then dance faster, like kind of was kind of doing it at multiple levels. And then what they did was they sped up the music, or they slowed down the music, to see if the cockatoo could actually follow that. And it seems like it could. So I think definitely with training, they can do it. I don't know how innate it is, but I think, yeah, I wouldn't rule it out at all.
Let's see. I just want a universal beat. You know, there's a beat to the universe that we all dance to.
But even like when you're in a concert and people are clapping along, like some people are clapping on one beat and some people are clapping faster or slower. Like you can see, even there in humans, there's a lot of variation on where we're feeling the beat as well.
All right. Okay. So people are just getting it wrong. Maybe just don't have the rhythm down as much.
Yeah.
Which also, I know I do. Also. When I try to move, talk and clap my hands, my rhythm's way off. But yeah. So I guess on this topic of like what you're studying as well, like what is the actual, and I'm not saying that I think study for its own sake is amazing, but like what is the real world kind of benefits of like what you're doing now with the grammatical prediction thing or anything else related to this? What is like, and it doesn't have to benefit. You can make this many dollars with it, but like, as in, what is the actual like use of it? I guess is it outside its sphere? Is there views to its benefit?
Yeah, definitely. So with the rhythm stuff that we're doing now, so basically you've got two sides, right? You've got the fundamental research. So this is kind of what I'm really interested in. How does the brain work, right? That's kind of this fundamental question, like a music and language processed in similar areas, and what does that mean? But you've also got this really applied side, especially in terms of rhythm, because there's a lot of, so the stuff we're doing, if we can help people predict speech who have troubles with prediction, for example, we can benefit their language processing. So we've been studying children who have developmental language disorder. It used to be called specific language impairment, and also dyslexia. So if often one of the theories behind why people with dyslexia or DLD is a developmental language disorder have trouble with phonological awareness or reading or kind of speech processing sometimes, is that perhaps their neural oscillations aren't tracking or aren't synchronizing so well to the speech signal. So if we can train, like, because music is so regular, so predictable, we can use music to kind of train these neural mechanisms to help the speech processing. So it's really applied here. And there's a lot of research looking at music training in general and music rhythm training in particular to kind of boost different types of language skills. And there's a lot of research kind of getting bigger, is kind of more recent as well, but we're getting a lot more kind of evidence to suggest that music rhythm training can help language processing in typically developing children and also children with developmental language disorders. So it's really applied on that side as well.
Yeah. Surely that would mean there's benefits for the other side of the age spectrum. So for people getting older and trying to have memory impairment, yeah, like that could help there as well, I guess.
Totally. There's a lot of research on dementia. No, everything you're saying is good. Yeah. There's a lot of research on dementia in particular, and how, because music is so powerful because it activates so many areas in your brain, and you have really strong emotional and memory kind of ties to music. So there's all these great videos of people who have dementia who you play them their favorite song from 50 years ago and suddenly they're back, you know, they're dancing, they're moving, they're singing, they're remembering. And same like with Parkinson's disease, often they have trouble walking regularly. And there's a lot of kind of staccato, I guess, not able to move fluidly, basically. But if you play like a rhythm, suddenly they're dancing, they're moving. So one of the ideas is that if your internal timing mechanisms are a bit impaired somehow, and this happens across a lot of different disorders, the timing is really important. If you're presenting some kind of regular rhythm, actually you can really help movement. You can help speech, like in stuttering, for example. There's a lot of training to help people speak more fluently. And even in aphasia, so people who have a stroke and lose their language ability, there's something called melodic intonation therapy where you can take people. I think this was in The King's Speech. Have you seen this movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So I think he couldn't speak or couldn't speak very well and
stutter.
And you give music, because music's generally processed on the right side of the brain, not completely, but you can rewire the networks on kind of the music side to process the speech, which is kind of the damaged area. So then if you start singing and you're tapping at the same time, so you have this rhythmic element and you're singing, how are you, something like this, you practice singing and people with aphasia can often sing. And the goal is to make it less and less melodic and more like speech.
Right.
So there's loads of applications.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful already. Doesn't that suggest though that there is a difference, music and language, in the brain, if that's the case?
Yeah, for sure. So there's both similarities and differences, which is what makes it super interesting. So language generally is more left hemisphere, like it's processed on the left side more, and music is generally processed more on the right. I mean, so and there are different time scales involved, and there are obviously kind of language has referential meaning. Like if I say a sentence, you pretty much know what I mean, what I'm trying to communicate. But if I play beautiful music song, it could mean different things to different people. So I think the power of music is that it is both similar and different to language. So you can use the differences, like the really regular, predictable beats, to then help language, for example.
Yeah, I think it's super fascinating, because straight away my brain goes with that, like, because in my head I'd be like, music's more fundamental than language, simply just because the structures involved in language are much more complicated and whatever, and music's just so pure in its expression and it's more emotional, essentially, like, as in it's hitting you on that level. So like I would almost look at music as the foundational thing that then language could spring from, rather than vice versa, if you know what I mean. Like that's what I would think, but obviously I'm not a scientist.
I mean, so that's super interesting, because people are trying to figure out like what came first, right? It's like chicken or the egg sort of thing. And one of the theories is from Darwin, of course. He's very great at these things. There's this proto language. So the idea is back in the day, before music language were as we know it today, people kind of communicated in kind of like murmurs, like like different types of symbols and kind of making different sounds. And basically the idea is that this system, so music and language were combined, right? We just made these sounds and it got more and more complex. And as it got more and more complex, language evolved for, this is called referential meaning, like non-ambiguous, like you need to go to the shop and buy a, I don't know, milk, you know, whatever. Yeah. It must be milk. But we got really specific. So as our social groups got bigger and bigger, we needed to find a way to communicate, right? So the idea here is that language developed to be able to communicate more specifically, and music developed for the kind of more emotional side to kind of communicate emotions. There's a lot of theories of evolution of how music and language separated, what came first, whatever. But I really like this idea that there was initially some kind of thing that was a combination of both, and then we kind of split.
I guess it makes sense from the idea that if you're starting off with grunts and growls like what a monkey would do, then slowly that would just get more elaborate without having any detail to it. So it would just be more basic, and then, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. And like the best way you can hear it if you can't do anything else would be modulating the pitch and the sound, because, yeah, like, oh, means scared, but ah, means come over here, like as in, yeah, so, huh.
That's
very cool.
That the whole sad is kind of the lower pitch and the more slow, that I think that's very innate, actually, how we prescribe these emotions to sounds. So I think that's really super interesting. And I always find it interesting how similar languages are to each other, actually. Like, there's pretty much a direct translation of every word. Like, if you go from French to English, for example, even though these are quite similar. I don't know. I find it really interesting. But there's a lot of theories about, yeah, how music and language evolved, basically. But typically, I think people think that it evolved from something that was similar, and then the different important elements of each music and language were kind of developed.
Yeah, yeah, which I really love that theory a lot. I've never heard that before, and just because it puts music on the equal level almost with language in a way, of as a form of expression, even though
we
need language to survive in society. But yeah, it puts music on that. Okay, that's
so
cool.
We actually did a study about this to see if we could kind of try to create evolution in the lab, and it was kind of cool. Like, we made these words that didn't mean anything, like Buffy Paga or something like this, and we recorded them and we gave them to the first participant. We said Buffy Paga, and the participant had to repeat it, Buffy Paga. And we told the participants what it meant, like, this is grass or this is hill or whatever. And then the next participant on a different session heard the production of the first participant, and so on. So it was kind of this idea of kind of a generational change, and you see how things change. And there were kind of differences between the speech and the pitch people used for emotional things, and the pitch people used for referential things. So if we were trying to say, oh, this is a stone, this is a tree, people were more close on their syllables, like they were better able to recreate the syllables. But if we say, oh, this is sadness or this is tenderness or whatever, the syllables weren't so precise, but the pitch was really different. So
that's so cool. I don't know if this is too much of a deep dive for anyone outside of me and you right now, but I find that just so interesting. Like, because even in a communication point of view, it's almost like if you can remember that. I think sometimes I know I have this habit horribly growing up where I just would not pay attention to anything. So, like, I feel like appreciating that can actually make you communicate better, because you, like, understand what you're saying and what you're trying to get across almost. So, yeah, no, that's really, I love that.
Yeah, that's cool. So I think we were kind of the first people to try to show as evolution in the lab, which is almost impossible, right? But we have tactics like this, which is kind of cool. I find it really interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've studied now for how many years? So it's understandable.
Yeah, a while now. It's good.
Yeah. Now, look, I could sit here and talk about this stuff all day, but I feel like we're going to get lost in the weeds if we go too far.
Okay.
The only other part I would want to say is how your love of this. So you coming out from the music side. So the psychology side, you said psychology. It doesn't sound like this. Yeah, is this psychology? Because the psychology I always picture is someone, you know, and their emotional state and stuff like that. Like, the interaction here seems a bit more tenuous. Was that because you kind of always wanted to go in this direction, or am I completely mislabeling it, saying it's tenuous? Or yeah,
no. So basically, psychology is pretty much understanding how we work, right? How humans work. So you've got this one side, which is the more therapy side, right? Where we're trying to help people. We're using like cognitive behavioral therapy, or we're still trying to understand how the brain works, but we're applying it to try to help people with their problems, right? But the other side of psychology, which is what I am really interested in, is cognitive psychology. Like, how does the brain work? And that's really, so I would say I'm a cognitive psychologist now, specializing in music psychology. So how does the, it's still the question, how does the brain work? And everyone, there's this nice meme or something saying that the brain tells us that the brain is the most complicated structure in the world, you know, and we're all just trying to figure out our own brains. And it's this super, super complicated thing, which is awesome. But I think we're trying to figure out, there's a lot of debate still in the field if music and language are totally represented in the brain in different ways, or if there's some overlap, or if there's, no one says there's total overlap. So usually we look in terms of this structure and kind of how it's processed in the brain. But the idea is if we have overlapping systems, we can use one to help the other, for example. So I wouldn't say it's different. And there's a lot of music therapy as well, which people use music to help people express their feelings if they can't express them verbally, for example. Or music training, which can like if you have a speech or language disability or disorder, sorry, like music could be a really nice way to help train this system without having to, because obviously speech therapy is amazing for this and it focuses directly on the problem. But music could be another way, kind of more motivating, fun, social way to activate and help these systems without having to focus on the same thing over and over. And there's so much extra to music, like the emotion, the repetition, like everything that really helps make, it kind of really activates a lot of the brain, whereas language is maybe a bit more specific. So I think music is really useful for that.
Yeah. And I guess, okay. And one last thing before we sign off, and this might be, is all music the same? Or is it like, and like, is there, you know, like there's the classical music, the grand big music, and then there's like obviously the more simplistic, but like pop, run-of-the-mill, generic sort of stuff, which is kind of just very simplistic. Is there like a noticeable difference in the appreciation of each of these forms, and is there a difference in how like people engage with it? And like, I don't want to use the word better, but appreciating a more complex piece of music is more engaging of all the facets of your brain, let's say. I'm totally leading you in a direction here, how to answer the question, which you can totally go in a different direction. But like compared to like pop, you can be like, well, you like almost would you be like, oh, you're missing out just listening to that. You could lose this and it's actually better for you in all of these other ways beyond just obviously it's fun. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I'm not going to pick a horse on that one either. But I think obviously the classical music often has a lot more expression and structural complexity, which is very, very valuable. And you had this whole Mozart effect from a while ago. Like if you play your baby Mozart, they're going to be smarter, like this whole thing. And this has been debunked now, right? It's just music in general is great. And often, I mean, because it's like simplistic, like pop music, for example, it's still very rhythmic and very repetitive and good for your brain. Like I don't think one type of music is like better. I'm putting my quotation marks here. But I think all types of music, if you enjoy it and if it brings you emotion, if it if you feel it, yeah. Like my old PhD supervisor is looking at aggressive music and whether this, like what happens with people who love this really, really aggressive music. And actually it just matters that they love it, right? It doesn't matter what it is really. So it's more how you perceive the music and how it affects you, I would say. All music is good, we'll say.
Yeah, no, that's I was trying to catch you on something, but no, you kept playing. No, that's fair enough. I think just enjoying it and actually listening to and appreciating it, that's like the key, regardless of what it is you're taking in.
Yeah. I mean, it all of it has really great things. All of it helps the brain, I would say.
Okay, cool. Well, look, we've done a deep dive on music. Like, I think I hope everyone else kept along, but I very much enjoyed that. I could talk about this stuff all day. I've always focused on the language side, but the music Fascinates me. Okay, well, let's call it there. Is there any last things you would say, for any shout out you want to give? Sometimes people have a Twitter account or something, but is there anything you would say people look up for you or to follow before you
start? Yeah, sure. I do have a Twitter account. I'm a modern scientist these days. So it's my name, but with a 5. So Anna, the number 5, and then Ash.
Okay, put that link in. Cool. Yeah, okay, awesome. Anything else before we sign off you want to talk about?
No, it's great. Okay. Play music, listen to music. It's great.
And appreciate it. Yeah. All right. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks a lot for that, Anna.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itsinas.
Kayla Itsinas. I'm Kayla Itsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.